90.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. Andrea Rayner grew up in Cincinnati, went to college at Denison University in Central Ohio, and then ended up at Harvard's Divinity School. She tells her story in her new book, Incognito, Lost and Found at Harvard Divinity School. She joins me to talk about how even she was surprised at the life path she took. Then later in the hour, we'll hear about the Western College for Women, now a part of Miami University. Jacqueline Johnson, the Western College archivist at Miami University, will join us to discuss her book. But first, Reverend Rayner. Yeah, you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, Andy.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here today. Your book is really interesting. It talks a lot about your life and how you made some decisions, and you take us back some to your childhood, and then as you go on with the future. So there's a little bit of everything in there to let us know where your life leads after Harvard Divinity School. Why did you decide to write this book? Why did you decide this would be a book that you'd like to share with others?
Well, I had written a book that came out 4 years ago called The Voice That Calls You Home, and it was a collection of essays really having to do with my work currently as a hospice chaplain and the work that I did at Ground Zero after 9/11 and then my experience with breast cancer. And when I was doing talks around that book, the things that people most were interested in was Ground Zero, because not much had been told about the blessings of remains that were taking place there. And they always wanted to know, how did you decide to become a minister? Those were the two big questions. Tell me about Ground Zero. How did you decide to become a minister? So in conversation with my agent and with people who had read the first book, I realized that it might be interesting for people to not only enter my life during those turbulent times of trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do, but it might also prompt them to think about their own lives, the choices that they had made, how they arrived from point A as maybe a young teenager or college student to point B as a mother, a father, a engineer, a doctor. So it was maybe in part to lighten things up a little bit, because the first book deals with such heavy topics. There is humor in there. And also just to have a little fun with it, because those were really wonderful years for me.
Well, let's talk about why you decided to become a minister. It was not in your plan, even though you ended up at Harvard Divinity School. Tell us how you got there and why at first you said, absolutely, I'm not here to be a minister.
Well, I started out at Denison, a bio pre-med major. From the time I was in high school, I was just very intent on becoming a doctor. I knew I wanted to be in a helping profession. I thought, well, if you do well in school and you have that impulse to help, medicine is really the best way to do that. When I got to Denison, I was a bio major. I did fine in the sciences until I came to chemistry. And I just basically did a nose plant in chemistry. And so I had to start reevaluating, are the sciences really my strength? Is that really what I should be focusing on, or am I forcing myself into that field? So I had a complete tailspin trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I had the opportunity to study abroad, a junior semester abroad in Vienna, gave me a little time to think, and I came back to Denison my senior year without even a major declared. So since I had taken religion classes all along out of interest, not out of a desire for a major or even a minor, my advisor and I sat down, and if I took all religion classes my senior year, I would be able to graduate with a major and on time. And through the course of that year, I realized how much I enjoyed the study of theology. So again, my impulse was to be in a helping field, maybe with the hungry, the homeless. Even though I grew up in a very religious home, we were United Methodists, I just didn't see myself in that role as a minister. It seemed constraining to me, a little, could I be myself? I didn't have any women ministers growing up, even though the Methodists have been ordaining women since 1956. That wasn't my experience. I didn't have that model, and I couldn't see myself there.
So it's interesting to me, when people think of Harvard, you think of the law school and the business school. I have to be honest, until I read your book, I didn't know there was a divinity school at Harvard. How did you find out about it?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is that Harvard was established as a college for young men who were interested in the ministry. So it's in Harvard's charter that they cannot exist without the divinity school. So in the 60s and 70s, when religion was really not a popular thing at all, there was a thought at the time to close down the divinity school, but they literally cannot do that because Harvard was established for the purposes of training young men for the ministry. So, I knew there was a Harvard Divinity School, as I did. There was Yale and Princeton, Columbia, and other lesser known institutions. I never thought that was accessible for me. I didn't grow up in a family with tons of resources. And luckily, I had an advisor who said, you should go to divinity school. And I thought, well, I don't want to be a minister. I know that, but you should go not only to divinity school, but you should go to Harvard. And I kind of laughed. I said, yes, of course I should go to Harvard. I should also sprout wings and fly across the sky. And so I wouldn't have thought to reach for that had I not had a wonderful advisor who said, you know what, even your application fee is waived. If you don't apply and it's free for you to apply, then shame on you. So I applied to one divinity school, one graduate school. It was Harvard. And when I got in, I thought my father was going to rent a plane and ride across the sky. My kid got into Harvard.
So it was a big step. You start the book talking about traveling with your parents in the car to Harvard. They tell you not to become a universalist, I guess. And
yeah, their big concerns at that point were not necessarily me leaving Ohio or being in the East Coast or even maybe being in a more of a urban setting. Their big concern is stay away from the Unitarians.
Or Unitarians, not Universalists, right.
And I think their thought, and maybe rightly so, was that Harvard was not a seminary. It wasn't, say, Asbury Seminary, where a lot of my pastors had come from in Kentucky, which is a great seminary, but a little more conservative thinking. I think they were concerned that when I went to divinity school, I might lose my center. And that was that kind of Christ center that I had had growing up and the thinking through my, the spirituality that I explored through my parents' faith, through my own studies. I think they just wanted me to stay centered and not lose perspective as I went into this very academic setting. Because you can imagine at a place like Harvard where you have people who, in one class, you'd have a rabbi, a priest, a Tibetan monk, atheist, a fundamentalist, agnostic. It was very easy to dissect the divine and kind of slice God up on the, you know, autopsy table. So I think they just wanted me to stay centered.
Well, you did have a lot of experiences and a
yes.
lot of different people. You lived in one of the divinity school dorms.
Yes.
And it sort of opened up. I love how you had, back then there were no cell phones. You had to share a phone by, you know, keeping it in the hall or
exactly.
sharing it from one apartment to the other. And the people that you thought were going to be your best friends weren't necessarily, and those, the girl from Connecticut ended up being one of your closest friends.
Exactly. Yeah, it was my friend Catherine, actually from Vermont.
Oh, Vermont, the East
again,
Coast.
I mean, I think I was so green in a way. I had never even met someone from Vermont. I saw that as more of like a Hallmark movie place. And my best friend, Catherine, my best friend now, she is the daughter of Frederick Buechner, who is a very well-known theological writer, probably one of the most quoted theological writers by ministers and priests across the country. But Catherine was from Vermont. When we met, she was 24. I was 22. She was already divorced at that time. It was outside of my realm of experience. And she used to joke, yes, it was, you know, good guy, wrong girl, short marriage, long story. And we ended up having a lot of great adventures together. And we did each other's weddings, officiated each other's weddings.
Did you? Oh,
we're godparents cool. to each other's children.
I'm talking with Andrea Rayner, Andy Rayner. Her book is Incognito, Lost and Found at Harvard Divinity School. If you'd like to join the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Well, as you were there and sort of discovering, and you talk about some of the fabulous professors that you had while you were at the Harvard Divinity School, you also had this crazy social life going on at the same time. I don't think many people, when they're thinking of ministers, think about, you know, them having seven or not seven, I'm exaggerating, three or four different boyfriends going at once there. Why was that important? I mean, that's a really a theme sort of going through the book, all this that was going on with your high school boyfriend and then the college boyfriend and then people you met there. What role did all of that play in your growing up and becoming who you are today?
Well, I think, again, you have to go back and try to remember what it was like when you were 22. And for me, it was kind of my first, even though I'd gone to Vienna for a semester in college, it was different. This was my first foray out really into a different setting. And so I think of it as a maturation process. I mean, I'm really grateful for having a wonderful high school boyfriend, I have to say, a little shout out. I was really lucky, but
I mean, you're from Cincinnati. I don't know if we said that from the Grosbeck area. So yeah. Is he still in Cincinnati?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I went to, Corrine High School, which I had a great education there. So I think, it was important for me to actually bring in that part, the relationship part, because really we were all pretty young people trying to figure out what we wanted to do, who we were kind of looking for love in a way, and what would it be to explore this relationship or that, or who am I as I leave the nest of this very safe high school relationship and even the very beginning of a relationship in college to then being on my own. And Harvard, like other schools in Boston and Cambridge, you have just such an infusion of people under 30. If you're over 30 in Cambridge, you're old, honestly. So there were people from all over the world. And I think for me and for other friends there at the Div School, we were exploring what we were supposed to be doing with our lives. And in a sense, who would be the partner we would want walking with us. So even though I do mention a lot of different men that I had met. I have to remember I had very little time too. So out of this, say, 4 or 5 year span of time, I was in school full time. I was working 25, 30 hours a week. And then you'd get a couple hours to relax or exhale. So, it wasn't as much time as it might appear in the book.
Well, it seems like you didn't see these folks all that much, but they seemed to play big parts,
yes,
in your life and in helping you to make decisions and what was working and what wasn't working for you. And
right. And I guess in a way, you know, like the title Incognito, it's as we meet new people, it's how much of ourselves are we revealing to that person and how much are they revealing to us? And, you know, trying to figure out, can I be myself in a church setting? Can I be myself with this young man from Colombia that I've just met on the street? And what am I learning about myself in that relationship? And, you know, what am I gaining? What am I learning from the other person? So I was making a lot of decisions, as I was in school about my calling and also about, relationships. It was really a parallel track. Because my college boyfriend, who is now my husband, kind of hung in there with me. He was 3 hours away in Connecticut, and I was in Boston. And we decided to try to date other people. But in a way, as my calling became clearer, that relationship also became clearer. And we came together really as I became more committed in my ministry.
Well, and he had a calling of his own.
Yes, he did.
You talk about how you were deep in Harvard Divinity School and he was doing other things. And then it all came down to piano and suddenly there was this switch and you were getting out and he was just starting. What did that do to your relationship?
Well, initially, you're right. I was graduating from Divinity School and he had decided to go to music school in Cambridge. And he had been an English major at Denison, and all of a sudden he was focusing in on music. And so having him go from 3 hours away to three blocks away, I was in complete freak out mode initially. I was used to having my space. I was used to, you know, doing my own thing and exploring these other relationships. So it was a huge adjustment at first. And I'd say, after about 2 or 3 months, all of a sudden we just looked at each other and realized how much there was between us. And as his sense of calling to become a music teacher really solidified, then I think we both kind of relaxed and could see ourselves growing together. me in the ministry and then him with his calling in music. Until he found that calling, it was much harder on our relationship.
It's interesting with you, you were still struggling with what you were going to do with this degree from the Harvard Divinity School, and you at one point finally decided maybe you wanted to be a minister, but you tried out a lot of different things. You worked at a shelter for homeless men. Tell us about what that experience was like and what you gained from it. Because you described some situations there that sound pretty awful to me, and you seem to get a lot of satisfaction out of it.
Yeah, I worked at the Pine Street Inn, which was the largest shelter in Boston at the time. I did a year of field work there. 2 years of field work were required for my degree. The Master of Divinity is a 3-year master's. It's a long master's. And so, I don't know. I just felt called to that setting. It was difficult. There were about 350 beds for men. There were 50 beds for women on another side. And in the dead of winter, you'd have another 200 or 300 men sleeping on the floor. And as you can imagine, they were, many were mentally ill. They were addicts. They were young, old. It was a rather dangerous place to be in many respects. And I was one of the few women. And again, I was that ripe age of 22 when I started there. But what most compelled me about it is I felt very centered spiritually when I was at Pine Street. And in many ways, it informed my own theology. I always say it kind of saved my life. I feel like I met God in a deeper way at Pine Street. And so when I would leave the shelter and take the T back to Harvard Square and walk through Harvard Yard, I was carrying those stories with me. And I felt like if Jesus had been walking with me, he would have been more comfortable at Pine Street than sitting in the library at Harvard.
Tell the story of a very clarifying moment with one man who wasn't making a lot of sense and then suddenly did as you were just trying to help him.
Yeah, this was probably the most transformative moment of my life, and that it was a very busy time at the Pine Street Inn. We always had an officer at the door who would frisk the men for weapons or alcohol when they came into the shelter. I was, as a student, I was kind of that spare part. Sometimes I'd be giving out bed tickets. Sometimes I would be running somebody to first aid. And at the time, you could just have to imagine maybe, 300 homeless men streaming through a door. They're hungry. They're tired. They're cold. They're cranky. They're mentally ill. And in the midst of that commotion, the police brought in a man who they'd found on the street. And it's tragic, but so many people have frozen to death not far from shelters. And maybe he had passed out. He was definitely intoxicated. So they brought him in, deposited him in a chair. And one of the counselors on staff said, "Would you go try to get a name out of that guy? See if there's some ID that he has." So this little man, he was probably only 60, but he looked 75. The street has a way of aging you. He was absolutely incoherent, sitting in a chair, almost falling off. I was down on my knees, kind of holding him up. And I just kept saying, "Sir, can you give me your name?" And he was drooling that he smelled of vomit and urine. His hands were filthy, and he just wasn't making sense. I thought he was saying John or Jim or George. It was completely incoherent. I was about to give up. I didn't know what to do because there just was nothing coming out of him. And right when I was about to say to the counselor, "I can't understand him," he opens his eyes and he looks at me, and with absolute clarity, he said, "Are you the one God sent to me? Are you the one?" And at that moment, I had no words. And he paused just briefly and then said, "Because if you're the one God sent to me, then God sent me to you. Then God sent me to you." And after that, not another word came out of that man. He went back to his drooling and his incoherency. And I was just stunned. And I realized that I wasn't really supposed to be some do-gooder there at the shelter, but I was there to learn and to find the divine in these people. Because if that man were the only person on earth, at least in my faith, Jesus would have died for him. So that moment transformed how I saw my work, how I saw my studies, and kept me centered in my faith.
I'm talking with Andy Rayner. She's the author of Incognito, Lost and Found at Harvard Divinity School. If you have a question or a comment, 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. The name Andy is big in your life. Andrew is calling from Avondale. Hi, Andrew. What's your question?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes. What's your question, sir?
I've wondered a little bit about the ministry for myself, partly because, I don't fit in, it seems, anywhere else. I have a master's degree in mathematics, but since I got it, I've not held any job beyond, continue to be a teaching assistant for a while. I haven't held any job that required more than a high school diploma other than that. There's certain parts of the Bible that speak to me, like, whatsoever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. But other parts leave me cold.
What do you think, Andy? What do you think he should do?
Well, I think if you feel a calling, I think that's the most important thing, is that you should feel a calling to whatever work you do, whether you felt a calling towards being a math teacher or a calling towards being anything. I think we need to have a calling, and in the ministry, you really need to feel that call. I think if you take some classes, either at a seminary or a divinity school, and see how that speaks to you, stick your toe in the water. And I think just the more clear you are about even wanting to embark on the journey, you don't really have to know where you're going to end up. But if you feel compelled to explore, I think, intellectually, spiritually, personally, what the ministry would be for you, then it could be an exciting time.
Andrew, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. If you have a question or a comment, 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. Along with working at the shelter for men, you also got to live in the dean's house on campus. I guess that was your last year in divinity school. That provided you with some interesting experiences as well.
Yeah, I actually lived at the dean's house for 2 years. It's a large house called Jewett House. It's right across from the main building of the Div School. That was a great opportunity for me because, again, I was on scholarship and loans. So there were three students who lived in the dean's house, two of whom were, say, the maids, and one did the cooking. And so I was the maid. And so for free room, not board, but for free room, I would clean the dean's house. I had 9 bathrooms and a bazillion bedrooms. And when
they had a lot of guests.
When visiting scholars would come, I would make up the rooms. And when dinners happened, we would serve the dinners. And that really allowed us an interesting bird's eye view into some of our professors and the visiting scholars. For example, just the beloved theologian and priest Henry Nouwen was a teacher at the school then, and he was so horrified to have us serving him. It was kind of comical and so touching to see Henry being uncomfortable with being served. He would have much rather been in the kitchen with us. And another very well-known scholar at the time was more interested in kind of peeking down our shirts as we served the dinners and waters than necessarily coming and thanking us. So it was interesting to watch that dynamic, both with the scholars, with the dean and his family. But it was actually a lot of fun to live there.
You also had some time in a church.
Yes.
This is, again, before you decided that you were going to become a minister. And you worked with a minister named Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this as being a very good time. Tell us a little bit about that. What was it like when you first became you weren't an associate pastor there, but an assistant student there?
Well, it was, I was so lucky. Again, I've had wonderful advisors in my life, and my advisor at the Div School asked me my second year, were you even a tiny bit considering being a minister? And I said, well, I actually think more women should be ordained. I had Catholic friends, women friends who said, we're pounding on the door. It's wide open to you. I can't believe you're not at least exploring it. So I said, well, I'd like to cross that T anyway and make sure I don't want to. So he suggested I do an internship, a field year with a young pastor who had also graduated from the divinity school about 5 years earlier. And he and his wife became just lifelong friends of mine. And that was a very positive experience because Michael was brilliant. He was a great pastor, a really wonderful speaker. But he had so much intellectual integrity as well. So that was really where I found my call. The very first time that I was there at the church, he was having me start with the call to worship. And when I got up to read the call to worship, it was one of those almost movie experiences where time literally stood still. The hair on my arm stood up. And I thought, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And the second flash was, oh no, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. There's a mistake here. So, but I did feel that call. And after that, my friendship with Michael and his encouragement, and he was always himself, and he was very funny. And I thought, well, he's still got this long, remember, this is like the 80s, he's got this kind of like rocker mullet look here. And his wife was a critical care nurse. And just I thought, well, maybe there is a possibility for me to be myself and be a minister.
He asked you to do something that you were not excited about initially, and that was to go find a collar and
yes.
start wearing one. And I should say, as you sit here today, you are definitely not wearing a collar,
no.
dressed in certainly what anyone would describe as normal street clothes, civilian clothes. Why was it important that you wore a collar at that time?
Well, again, Michael was very supportive of women in ministry. And he said, you know, by being a young woman, you should be proud of it. You are helping break that open for other women and for, you know, people who have never had a minister as a woman as a minister. So, Michael was very intent that I get the collar. I wasn't ordained yet, so I didn't feel completely comfortable, but I was going to be ordained soon. So he was trying to get me used to it. He sent me, unfortunately, to Sheehan's, which was the largest Catholic supply, store in Boston. My chapter in Incognito is, does this collar make me look fat? And, when I went, I felt like such a poser. They looked at me with complete suspicion. I'm looking through these shirts, trying to act professional. And, an older gentleman came up to me and basically said, excuse me, miss, but we do not sell collars for Halloween.
And it was close to Halloween.
It was close to Halloween. I didn't think of that. And I just started to laugh. I said, of course, you know, he thinks I'm buying it for Halloween. But I was able to have a little interaction with him, which was so tender, and saying, listen, you know, I'm United Methodist minister, and we've been ordaining women for how many years now, 30 years. And he just changed. He said, well, certainly let me help you. And that was such a beautiful thing. The other time that I've really had to wear a collar was when I worked at Ground Zero. And again, the collar invited a different kind of dialogue. It was clear that I wasn't a Red Cross volunteer or Salvation Army or, another sort of volunteer. The collar invited workers to have a particular conversation with me. So I've worn it very selectively because it invites both projections and also wonderful dialogues.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question for Andy Rayner, she's the author of Incognito, Lost and Found at Harvard Divinity School. AJ's calling from Mount Washington. Hi, AJ. What's your question?
Hey there. Throw my question out there and then I'll, whatever, let you guys discuss it. But my question was regarding the terminology, Andy, that you're using, calling. You keep talking about feeling a calling and feeling a call. And I was wondering, where do you find the balance of feeling this calling versus making decisions on your own? Just because I know the Bible is pretty gray, Christian-esque theology in general doesn't have a lot of specific things to say about feeling a call or being called to things. But, you know, again, you know, how do you find that balance of making decisions versus feeling called?
It's a really interesting question. You know, I think I sort of harken back to, the idea of that still small voice within us. And I think, sometimes we feel like we're feeling called to some way, and maybe we're wrong. Maybe that's just our desire. I mean, I thought I felt called to be a doctor. I think the impulse to help was that voice was saying, I was kind of created. It's in my DNA. I was here on the earth to hopefully help people, and I was filtering that through a medical setting. As it turns out, as a hospice chaplain, I get to work in a medical setting, but I'm doing it from a spiritual perspective. So that's maybe one area where I think I felt that call to be in a helping profession. Maybe my ego was filtering it through medicine, thinking that would be a great thing for me to do. But I think in terms of Christian theology or the Bible or Christian thinking, I really feel like God wants us to be ourselves. We come into this world, if we were like seeds, there'd be this perfect picture on the seed packet. And then we're planted and we try to become that perfect child that we were meant to be. So the calling would be going within, listening for the nudges of the Spirit, because I do feel like God speaks to us in so many different ways. And sometimes we have to go down, you know, we have to go down one road and find that it's a dead end, but that brings us to someplace else. So, you know, we didn't get that job that we felt called to do, but this other door opened, and that's, you know, that one has brought us to where we can most fully express ourselves in the world. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I feel like with myself, if we listen, there is that whisper of the Spirit that is trying to bring us to our perfect place as human beings. And hopefully that's in a place where we can be loving, be compassionate, and be fully human.
Thanks for your call, AJ. We appreciate it. Bill's calling from Camp Denison. Hi, Bill. What's your question?
Hi, good afternoon. I will make this very brief, and it is complimenting women as clerics. I have had a very unusual faith life. I was raised Roman Catholic through grade school and high school, attended. When I went to college, I left the Roman Church, but I looked into every other type of faith that I could find, as I was embarrassed. I didn't know anything about anyone else's beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so for a while, I was Episcopal. I was a member of the Methodist Church. I was a member of non-Protestant churches, big box churches, and so forth. The best clerical I ever had in my life was a woman priest in the Episcopal Church, a wonderful, wonderful priest. And I have no idea why, well, I have an idea why, but Roman Catholic Church really ought to be looking at women as priests.
Amen, and brother.
Well, thank you, Bill. We appreciate that. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you so much.
We just have a couple of minutes left. So I guess we should get to the point where, after all of this, you, of course, did become a minister. You went on to marry your college sweetheart and have continued your life there. You've also experienced some other rough situations. And you, as you said, you were at 9/11. You have a couple other books out as well, so people can find out about those there. What's the initial reaction to this book so far?
You know, it's been really fun, the reaction to this. With my kids being now basically college age, I'll ask my daughter in particular, you know, is this dated, Kat? It takes place in the 80s. And she has said to me, in fact, I talked to her best friend over the phone yesterday too, they've said, you know, Mom, this is still the essential question as we are college students, is what are we supposed to do with ourselves? How do we navigate relationships? She said it is the same question that all of us deal with, no matter whether it's the 80s or 2014. And so she said the reading your book is a way for us to have faith in the future, that if we keep following our dreams, if we don't sort of reach low, if we reach high, for me, it was a place like Harvard, you know, if we follow our dreams, if we follow our passions, and if we try to have integrity in our relationships, then we're going to end up in a good place. So it's been a really fun reaction so far for people who just want to dip their toe into my life a little bit and come to the Harvard Divinity School in the 80s just for fun. That's great. And if it has made them think about the choices they've made in their own lives or with the possibilities that might await them in the future, that's really gratifying for me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much. It's a lot of fun. Thank you.
I've been talking with Andy Rayner. She's the author of Incognito, Lost and Found at Harvard Divinity School. She'll be at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Rookwood Pavilion tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, discussing and signing Incognito. In just a moment, we'll talk to the author of Western College for Women, Jacqueline Johnson. She's the Western College Archivist at Miami University. This is Cincinnati Edition.